Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello and welcome. In case you missed it last week, I am starting a YouTube channel called Steph Today, where I'm going to be telling you even more crazy stories and cases, and my first video is up now. So if you want to check that out, I will have the link to that in this episode description, or you can find it over on our Instagram page. And I'm hoping to get my second video out to you soon. Also, bonus episode number 50 is out now on our Patreon, patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. Alex and I are discussing the case of Hannah Petty, who was poisoned with lead over the span of 6 months by someone very close to her. And by the time she made it to the hospital, doctors told her she maybe had one more day to live. She is an incredible survivor, and her story is out now over on Patreon, as well as 49 other bonus episodes. So go check those out as well. But today, I'm going to be diving into the case of Morgan Metzer, who survived an attempt on her life on New Year's Eve of 2020. But that is not where her survival story began. This case contains graphic details that may be distressing to some. Listener discretion is advised. In December of 2020, Morgan Metzer had been living in Canton, Georgia with her two children. It had been a long year. Morgan had recently been divorced, and her 8-year-old twin son and daughter were going to be spending a few days with Morgan's sister in Florida. So on New Year's Eve of 2020, Morgan went to her best friend, Nicole Stabosevsky's house. Their plan was to have a chill night in, have a glass of wine, and watch the ball drop together. But that night, Morgan told Nicole she'd have to leave early because she was really tired. Nicole was pretty disappointed because she said they never got to hang out like that anymore. They were both moms, and getting together took a lot of coordination. She did give Morgan a little crap, calling her a loser for going home so early, but ultimately just told Morgan to text her when she got home, and she'd see her soon. And with that, she headed out. When Morgan got home, she immediately started getting ready for bed. She didn't have any interest in waiting up for the fireworks. If she wanted to do that, she would have stayed with Nicole. So she closed everything down for the night and went to bed. When the fireworks did finally begin at midnight, Morgan was woken out of her sleep. She saw her pug at the end of her bed and told him Happy New Year, but then rolled over and went back to sleep. But the next thing she knew, she was woken back up. And this time, when she opened her eyes, she saw the figure of a man standing in her doorway. The intruder was dressed all in black, wearing a black hoodie, black pants, black gloves, and a mask, and was lit only by the light behind him. Morgan screamed at the top of her lungs when she saw him. She said, quote, "He's standing there like a soldier, with his fists clenched, and like he was ready to go. He ran at me and jumped on top of me, and that's when he started pistol-whipping me." Her attacker punched her, and then turned her over, pulled her hands behind her back, and put black zip-tie handcuffs on her wrists that were pre-looped and intertwined. She said, "As soon as I felt the gun right here in my head, I was like, all right, Jesus, I'm coming. I thought I was dead. But then also part of me was like, no, I'm not gonna let myself die. I gotta fight for my kids." Her attacker continued to hit her and pistol whip her, and then strangled her nearly to unconsciousness twice. Both of those times, Morgan believed she was about to die. He said very little, but when he did speak, Morgan recalled her assailant seemed to be disguising his voice, making it sound low and gravelly, almost like Batman. He said things like, "You've messed with the wrong people, and you're gonna pay. You're gonna regret this, and you've done really wrong now." Morgan was terrified, and having an out-of-body experience. She began thinking about her kids, and what would happen to them after she was killed. She had never made a will, and never even talked to her family about who would get them. But she really felt like soon her children would be left without a mother. She said it was the worst feeling in the world to think you're dying and feel like you're going to be tortured beforehand. And then Morgan's attacker sexually assaulted her. Morgan's mind raced, trying to piece together what was going on. She went through her whole life. She said it was like having 50,000 tabs open in her brain all at once. He demanded to know where she kept her valuables as he began ripping things out of her drawers. He also asked for her phone and for the passcode to her phone. Morgan's house had a very sophisticated alarm system, which she set every night before bed, and she had an app on her phone which controlled it, along with several security cameras around her home and a lock on the door of her second floor bedroom, which led out to the back porch. She said, quote, "I wasn't too sure what he was doing on my phone at the time until I heard a door lock open, which was for the back porch. The attacker had unlocked the door remotely through the app on Morgan's phone. Her attacker then put a pillowcase over Morgan's head and pulled her out of the bed. He walked Morgan out to the back porch. She was naked, still with her hands zip-tied and the handcuffs behind her back. Her attacker told her not to get up until she heard two car honks or he would kill her. And Morgan's property was secluded, which meant there was very little chance of a neighbor seeing or even hearing her on the back porch. And since she had a pillowcase over her head, she had no way of knowing if her attacker or possibly someone else was watching her. So she didn't take that threat lightly. She was too terrified to move a muscle. Morgan did her best to calm herself down, listening to a nearby stream to be as peaceful as she could manage. 45 minutes passed like that, and then a sound in the distance sent a sharp chill down Morgan's spine. She heard someone walking up the stairs that led to her back deck, and suddenly she was struck with terror once again. She wasn't able to see anything, so she had no way of knowing if her attacker had returned to finish her off. She could hear the distant sound of shuffling as someone walked toward her. She knew they were at the top when she heard whoever it was step on the first board, which creaked really loudly. And then Morgan heard the familiar voice of her ex-husband, Rod Metzer, say, "Oh, honey, what happened?" When Morgan's ex-husband, Rod Metzer, turned up at her house, he immediately called 911. He informed the dispatcher that there had been a break-in, and he found his wife on the back porch. She was tied up with a hood over her head, and the back door was left wide open. Rod had come to the rescue and saved Morgan. At least that's what he wanted Morgan to believe. But in reality, Rod was Morgan's attacker all along, and Morgan had a very strong feeling that that had been the case. Morgan first met Rod when she was 14 years old and he was 17, and it was love at first sight. It didn't take long at all before Rod and Morgan became boyfriend and girlfriend, and Rod was introducing her to his mother Kathy at one of his high school baseball games. At first, Rod treated Morgan like a princess. Anything Morgan wanted, Rod made sure she got. They went to every homecoming together, every prom together, and Morgan really felt like Rod was the whole package. She felt lucky to be with him. And when the couple got married in 2009, when Morgan was 21 years old, no one was surprised. They had been together for many years by that point, and they were so in love. Morgan was a beautiful bride, and their wedding was everything they could have dreamed of. However, only 8 months after their marriage, the couple dealt with an awful tragedy. Rod's younger brother, Kevin, lost his battle with leukemia at the age of 19, and Rod was beyond devastated. His mother, Kathy, said she doesn't think Rod was ever the same after Kevin's death, and from that point on, he depended on Morgan more than ever before. Kathy said, quote, "I don't think he left her side for more than an hour or two." The following year, Rod and Morgan got some really good news when they found out Morgan was pregnant with their son. And picking his name felt really easy at that point. Kevin had always wanted to be an uncle, and they knew how amazing he would have been, so they decided to name the baby after him. However, shortly after the baby was born, they suffered another devastating loss. Baby Kevin was born prematurely with a congenital heart defect and lived for only 18 days. That time was understandably a blur for Morgan and their family, so it seemed like a miracle when only 3 months later, Morgan learned that she was pregnant once again, and this time it was twins. Morgan gave birth to a healthy baby girl and boy in 2012, which should have been an extremely happy time for her and Rod. However, shortly after that, their marriage began to go downhill. Rod had been working as a day trader, and would often have outbursts of anger when things didn't go his way in the stock market. He would throw fits when things went wrong, screaming and cursing, and he would slam the door so hard that it would almost come off its hinges. He'd pick up items and throw them, he'd put his fist through the walls, and scream random horrible things. And when the twins were about a year old, Rod lost his job, which was when things started to go really downhill for them. Around the same time, Morgan had started a business, Shiplap and Sugar, and it was doing really well. It was an interior design business, and it was taking off. It became so successful that she had asked her best friend Nicole to join her in this business because Morgan had become so overwhelmed by how much demand she had that she needed someone else to join the team. So while Rod was floundering, Morgan was flourishing. And in theory, this shouldn't have affected Rod. If anything, this should have been a good thing for them. That while Rod was between work, Morgan was doing really well. But insecure men will do some pretty heinous shit when they feel emasculated. Morgan claimed it was around that time that Rod began abusing her, both physically and mentally. When she began showing bruises and signs of the physical abuse, he somehow convinced friends and family that she was the one who was responsible for them. He was so manipulative, he had even convinced Morgan that she had done it to herself at times. Morgan said the first night Rod had beat her was on Labor Day weekend while they were on a boat with friends. They had just returned to their cabin and they had gotten into an argument about something, which was when Rod became physical. Morgan immediately had her father come get her because Rod had put his hands on her, and that was a massive shock and escalation in their normal fights, which she knew was not okay. But that was when Rod convinced everyone that Morgan had created the marks on her body herself. He said Morgan was out of control. She couldn't keep her temper and was wailing all over the place. Morgan said Rod claimed she got hurt because he was forced to physically restrain her. And Morgan didn't know what to believe. She thought maybe there was a world in which this was her fault. She said from that point on, her friends sort of stopped talking to her because he was that manipulative that he got them to believe him, that Morgan was to blame for the marks on her body. He even got her parents to believe him. And as time went on, Morgan began doubting her own reality more and more. And as their marriage continued, things only got worse. Morgan would frequently get so overwhelmed by everything going on that she would hide in the closet in their home just to breathe. Rod was a master manipulator and gaslighter, and would make her think every conflict was instigated by her, when in reality, it was Rod who was picking the fights and was causing the marks. Rod even got their children involved in his deception in a really major way that I have to imagine was highly traumatic for them. He pretended Morgan pushed him down the stairs and rolled himself down the stairs, which caused actual commotion and pain, and then according to Morgan, told the kids, "Look, mommy pushed me down the stairs, can you believe that?" That is horrifying. I cannot even imagine having to deal with that kind of deception and manipulation and gaslighting. And at this point, Morgan of course knows that he's the one that's causing the marks, but the people around her don't believe her. Or they just do believe him. And of course, he's making her look terrible even to her own children, which is insane and so sad. Morgan's best friend Nicole said, "I think she thought she was crazy. You get programmed to think you're crazy, like it's all in your head." And she did. That's exactly how she felt, because it went on for so long, and everyone around her was basically telling her that it was her fault because Rod was that good at making them believe it. And as if that wasn't bad enough, things escalated from there. Rod began sexually abusing Morgan, although she said it took a while for her to even recognize what it was. Rod was very aggressive with her and wouldn't take no for an answer. So looking back on it, Morgan was able to realize that that was also very much a part of it. According to the National Domestic Violence Hotline, it is estimated that between 10 to 14% of married women are raped by their husbands in the United States. Studies indicate that 34% of women report experiencing some form of sexual coercion by a partner, and in abusive relationships, this percentage increases, with 40% to 45% of women experiencing sexual assault. Just because you're dating someone or married to someone does not mean you have implied consent. You still have to be a willing participant for it to be okay. And Morgan realized that that was not what was occurring. Following one of Rod's outbursts, Morgan decided she needed to take a break and got the kids into the car to take them to her parents' house. And as she sat in the driver's seat about to drive away, she looked back and saw Rod standing in the garage holding a gun, and he put it to his head as if he were about to shoot himself. Morgan screamed and covered her eyes, and after a few seconds of not hearing anything, she opened her eyes and uncovered her face, and when she looked up at Rod, he slowly lowered the gun to his hips and walked back into the house. This man was tormenting her. He wanted her to be terrified of him at all times. And I'm not sure if that was the last straw, but her last straw was definitely around that time because Morgan filed for divorce in 2020. And although divorce is rarely pretty, Nicole said this was the first time she had seen Morgan have any kind of peace. But that peace was short-lived because Rod would show up out of nowhere to holiday events, and he knew that if the kids were there, Morgan wouldn't make a scene in front of them. So he was just getting away with that pretty often. But their divorce was finalized in December, and by that point, Morgan was just ready to move on. But now, in the early morning hours of New Year's Day, Rod was back, seemingly as her knight in shining armor. But what had caused Rod to walk into Morgan's backyard well after midnight? She couldn't be sure yet, but at that point, Morgan was still extremely vulnerable, and Rod was playing the role of hero as he was on the phone with 911. While he was on the phone, Morgan begged him not to leave. And Rod told her he wasn't going anywhere. He was going to leave the door open while he was on the phone. Detectives from Cherokee County Sheriff's Department, Sergeant Dakota Livers and Sergeant Robert Haw, first arrived at Morgan's home at 3 a.m., and Rod's behavior was immediately strange. As they were walking up, Rod was seated in his car with another deputy when he asked Sergeant Livers, "Hey man, are you the guy that we've been waiting on?" And Sergeant Livers said, "Yes, sir, I am." And then Rod replied, "Do your effing job." And that struck Sergeant Livers as pretty odd. On one hand, this was a very emotional time for him. He had just found his ex-wife on the back porch, bound and beaten. But on the other hand, his arrival should have been more welcomed, considering he was there to solve what had happened and help. At least that's how Sergeant Livers felt. And when they made it inside and saw Morgan's injuries for the first time, they were both very taken aback. They had seen a lot in their careers, but Morgan's injuries were shocking. Her eye was swollen shut, it was black and blue, and she still had the zip ties around her wrist. Her attack seemed like a very emotional and personal one. Not only was Morgan physically very hurt, but the detectives could tell that she had suffered psychologically after the attack. She had expressed to them that she was very fearful that someone was still watching her, and that they were going to kill her if she moved. So she had laid on her back deck and waited. She had been outside, bound and unable to see, for over 40 minutes before Rod had arrived. Morgan was so terrified that she said it felt like it had only been around 15 to 20 minutes maximum, because her perception of time was so extremely altered by her fear. Along with the police, Morgan had also called her father and brother to come over. But the first thing the police did was separate Morgan from everyone so they could talk to her in the privacy of her home while everyone else waited outside. While she was with investigators inside, she told them she suspected her attacker was the very man who was pretending to be her hero. And Sergeant Livers asked, "You're talking about your ex-husband?" And Morgan simply said, "Mm-hmm." At first, Morgan told them she had no idea who her attacker had been. She thought that this was just some random man who was in her home. But then there had been one moment where things shifted and she knew that it was Rod. There was a moment during the attack when he said, "You're going to miss your husband." And Morgan replied, "No, don't hurt my husband. I love him very much." She wasn't sure if it was Rod at that point, but at that exact moment, the mood of the room shifted, and she said she knew that she was going to live. So that was strange. Her attacker also seemed to know about Morgan's personal life, specifically her recent divorce, which was another red flag. I guess he mentioned the divorce, which is like, why would a random break-in, someone who's coming in to just rob her, know about her divorce? Rod. Not very smart. Also, he just took her phone and used it to remotely unlock the back door, as if he had lived there before and had done it. That's not something that every house just automatically has programmed the exact same way. Like, you probably would have had to know where it was in her phone and how to unlock it for it to work easily. And he did. And then, following that was an even bigger clue. When her attacker lifted Morgan off the bed to bring her outside, that gave her a flashback to a moment many years earlier when she was pregnant with her twins. There were times when Rod would help Morgan out of that bed, and the way her attacker had gently helped her out of bed was so familiar, it was just like the many times Rod had lifted Morgan out of bed during her pregnancy. It was so unmistakably him, and that was when it solidified in her mind that this was Rod. It was like muscle memory, the way he had done it and the way it felt to her. But just because it was Rod didn't mean she was safe. I mean, obviously she wasn't. So she didn't say anything because she didn't know what he would do if she let on that she knew it was him. Morgan told investigators earlier that week Rod had shared some really terrible news with her. Rod had told Morgan that he had pancreatic cancer. When Rod called Morgan and broke the news, she immediately told him that she was there for him. He was the father of her children, and this was huge, scary news. Despite their rocky past, she wanted to be there for him. So Rod came over and showed Morgan doctor's notes, and they talked things over. He told her he hadn't broken the news to anyone else yet, so Morgan told him he could stay at her place for a little bit, because Morgan's a good person and she cares. She was letting Rod sleep on her couch because he had been so upset and freaked out about his diagnosis that she was worried about him and wanted to support him through it, even after everything he had already put her through. She is still being nice to him. And as the days passed, Rod continually begged Morgan to get back together with him, constantly bringing it up. But Morgan told investigators she really didn't want that, and she kept turning him down. And by the morning of December 31st, she had had enough. She also had enough of feeling the immense pressure of being his sole emotional support through this cancer diagnosis. So she insisted that Rod share the news with his parents. And when he refused to tell anyone else, Morgan told Rod it was time for him to leave. But that didn't stop him. Rod continued to text Morgan all day long, begging her to get back together with him, telling her he'll make enough money and she could quit her job right now. As if that was ever the issue in the first place, or that Morgan even wanted that. I certainly don't know Morgan, but it seems like she loved her job. She started this interior design business and was working with her best friend, and it was flourishing, which is amazing. So who knows if she even wanted that. If she did want to be a stay-at-home mom, that's great too, but she doesn't want to get back together with you, Rod, because you're an abusive asshole. It's not because you don't make any money. It's because you suck. Morgan had had enough of Rod, and she told him she'd be turning off her phone and spending the night of New Year's at her parents' house, which she didn't end up doing. She went to Nicole's, but that's what she told Rod. And no wonder she was tired when she got there. She was exhausted from dealing with all of this. What's so sad is that after Morgan told investigators all of that, she didn't expect them to believe her. Rod had made her feel so crazy for so many years that she didn't know that they would accept what she was saying. She was so programmed to believe that she was to blame. But everything started to change when Sergeant Livers told Morgan that he believed her. Morgan said she melted, saying, quote, "He heard me. I have not been heard in years. Nobody listened. Nobody heard me, and he heard me." So from that point on, their investigation into Rodney Metzer began. Before Morgan had even told Sergeant Livers that she believed Rod had been her attacker, he had a few questions for him, because it was strange that he just so happened to show up to her home in the middle of the night. So he wanted to know what his explanation for doing that was. Rod had moved out of Morgan's home and into his own apartment shortly after the divorce, so why was he there? Deputy Chief Assistant District Attorney Rachel Ash was wondering the same thing. She was also an investigator on the scene who works exclusively on domestic violence cases. And Ash claimed investigators were perplexed that Rod had come to Morgan's house that night, especially after she'd told him she would be at her parents' house. Rod had explained he was getting ready for bed, and as he was brushing his teeth, he heard a knock on his window. That knocking was accompanied by a voice in which he could only decipher the word Morgan. Concerned, Rod said he tried calling Morgan, but she didn't answer, so he assumed the worst. Rod told investigators he had gotten in his car and made the 12-minute drive over to his ex-wife's house, and despite being divorced, Rod said he was still looking out for Morgan, Their relationship went back nearly 20 years. Rachel Ash wanted to know why Rod hadn't gone to Morgan's parents' house, or even checked with them before going to her home, since she had said she would be there. But Rod claimed it was just out of habit. As Rod was telling detectives that he had tried to call Morgan to check in on her before going over there, Sergeant Robert Haw used that opportunity to ask Rod to hand over his phone and show them how cooperative he was. And Rod just gave them permission to go through his phone, which is pretty dumb on his part, because what they found on his phone was quite shocking. He had an iPhone, and in the hidden folder were nude photos of Morgan, which wouldn't necessarily be alarming considering they had been married only a short time before this. However, it was pretty apparent from the pictures that Morgan didn't know that Rod had been taking these pictures of her. And when they shared this information with Morgan, she was extremely alarmed. They had also discovered Rod had taken pictures of Morgan's cell phone, showing text messages between her and another man. It was a massive invasion of privacy, and illegal. So since they couldn't arrest Rod then and there for the attack of Morgan, since they couldn't prove he had been the one who had done it, they arrested him from Morgan's house for having those photos of Morgan on his phone. They had to get him into custody so they could start doing search warrants to keep him from destroying any evidence. And as he was arrested from her home, Morgan said she just felt angry and was also still in so much physical pain after the attack. I mean, she was in really bad shape. After searching Morgan's home, they figured out how Rod had gotten in without setting off the alarm. He had entered her home through a basement window. They found the screen had been removed. That window did have an alarm sensor, but it had been removed from the window and put together on the windowsill. So if the window had been opened, it wouldn't trigger the alarm system. Investigators believed Rod had disabled the sensor while he was staying at Morgan's house that week. Although the home security videos had been erased, there was other video from prior to the attack. The camera on Morgan's front porch caught Rod earlier that evening. Rod had dropped off a check and had left it underneath the mat on her front porch. It was a check for $56,000. He was basically trying to make this grand gesture, saying that he had all this money for her and she deserved it, and he wanted to show her that he could provide for her as a way to get her back. So when Morgan returned home, she did retrieve the check and put it on her kitchen countertop. But shockingly enough, investigators never found the check, so her attacker took the check. Investigators did quickly discover that Rod was actually broke, so if Morgan had deposited this check, it would have just bounced. It was likely just a way to get Morgan to come home that evening because she told Rodney that she was going to be at her parents' house for New Year's. The day after his arrest, investigators executed a search warrant on Rod's car and his apartment, and as soon as they walked through the door, they found a key piece of evidence. They located a bag of zip ties in his apartment and a portion of a zip tie that matched up perfectly with the ones that had been used on Morgan's wrists. Before arriving to her house, Morgan's attacker had pre-looped the zip ties on her wrists to make handcuffs. One of the zip tie handcuffs was pretty unique because it had two other zip ties that had been ratcheted onto it and then cut. And they basically found the tail portion of what had been cut off of Morgan's handcuffs in Rod's apartment. And they immediately sent it to the crime lab. And a lab scene technician was able to match the tail of one of the zip ties that they found in Rod's apartment to one of the heads of the zip ties they cut off of Morgan's wrists. The striations on the tail found in Rod's apartment lined up exactly with the ones found on Morgan's wrist. It was a perfect match. They never imagined finding that piece of evidence, but detectives knew at that point that they had their guy. And as if that wasn't enough, the search warrant brought more than just that. They found a book called Seven Ways to Be Her Hero, which lined up perfectly with the investigators' theory as to why Rod may have attacked Morgan. Sergeant Robert Haw said, "I believe he thought he was going to come in and rescue her and be the savior and win her back." Investigators hoped home security cameras would support their theory, but they quickly learned that all the videos from the time of the attack had been erased through the app on Morgan's phone, and they were never recovered. But now that they had this book, they had their motive. Next up in their search was Rod's internet history, and that proved even more damning. They found searches like how to change your voice, how to choke somebody unconscious, as well as how to crack an iPhone password, and how to get sympathy from your ex. One of the most appalling, but not necessarily shocking, was cancer diagnosis letter. Are we surprised? Because I wasn't. While searching Rod's outgoing emails, they found that Rod had set up a fake email account to create the pancreatic cancer diagnosis letter that he had shown Morgan. He'd even created a bill for a doctor's office to show that he was being treated for pancreatic cancer. He didn't have cancer at all. He faked it all to either gain sympathy and try to win her back, or to gain temporary access to her home to disable the sensor on the window in her basement. Or more likely, it was for both. Winning her back with cancer was plan A, and this was plan B. Two days after the attack, Sergeant Livers and Sergeant Tom Harris interviewed Rod. And during that interview, they confronted him about his health. They mentioned that he was diabetic, but asked if there were any other health issues he had. And Rod told them nothing as far as he knew. Then Sergeant Livers just came out with it and said, "I thought you had cancer. How did you tell her this cancer thing?" And Rod said, "I don't know if I should talk to you guys anymore. I'm starting to get a really bad feeling. What angle are you guys coming from?" And then they asked Rod about his internet search history and if he was interested in changing the sound of his voice. And Rod told them, maybe. He felt like his voice wasn't manly enough. And finally, they brought up the zip ties they found in his apartment, and he flat out denied having zip ties, as if that's gonna do anything. They found the zip ties in your apartment, dude. You can't erase zip ties they found in your apartment. Rod said, "I don't have zip ties." And Sergeant Tom Harris said, "I know you don't. We have them now." Rod said, "This is just starting to get squirrely." Yeah, Rod, it is starting to get squirrely. But you're still talking. Why, I wonder? Sergeant Tom Harris told him they took the zip ties they found in his apartment and compared them microscopically to the ones they cut off of Morgan's wrists, and they were a perfect match. And Rod's response to that? "There's something funny going on here." Sergeant Tom Harris said, "Did somebody break in and put them there?" Rod said, again, "There's something funny going on here." Sergeant Harris said, "Like what?" And Rod said, "I don't know." And when I tell you, when I read this transcript, the only thing I could picture was a cartoon of like a really dumb guy who just got bonked over his head with a big club and had like a circle of chirping birds over his head. And I'm positive that this man is evil and was very good at manipulating and caused as much damage to Morgan's life as she says, because, I mean, he obviously did. But he sounds really stupid in this interview. And I'm glad. That tickled me a little bit. Because at any moment, he could have said, "I'd like to have a lawyer," and the interview would have been over. But he just continued to play dumb. Or he just was dumb? I don't know. He's obviously just trying to pretend like he knows nothing about any of this stuff, and he's like trying to take the angle of like being the cooperative, like, "I've got nothing to hide," so... He also like kind of tried to imply that they planted the zip ties in his apartment, as if that would ever happen. Like, why would they do that? Rod is just such an evil, terrible man that I did enjoy him sounding like such a doofus. So, there is that. But one of the most startling pieces of evidence police found while searching Rod's computer was his suicide letter and his final letter to Morgan. Rod planned on killing Morgan and then killing himself, because if he couldn't have her, then nobody could. If it wasn't crystal clear before, now it was certain. This was all premeditated, not just a moment of insanity. If she hadn't said during the attack that she loved her husband very much, he most likely would have followed through on those plans. That's what he was intending to do, and it doesn't seem like he had any major plans for keeping her alive afterward. I mean, he's obviously doing a terrible job at it right now. So that discovery was terrifying for Morgan and for the police. Just that was what he actually was planning on doing. And Morgan was so smart to play that card because it saved her life. Hours after the interview with Rod Metzer concluded, he was charged with 10 counts related to the attack on Morgan Metzer, including home invasion, kidnapping, aggravated assault, and sexual battery. Rod's mother, Kathy, was devastated because she didn't believe her son was capable of doing that. And 2 days after Rod was charged, he talked to his mother on the phone, saying, "Why is she doing this to me? She knows it wasn't me." But unfortunately for Rod's mother, the evidence kept stacking. She would learn that her son was, in fact, capable of what police were saying he had done. Sergeant Haw was able to scan the barcode for the zip ties on his Lowe's app on his phone and was able to see that they were sold at Lowe's, and he went to the two Lowe's in the area and started searching for the transactions that had been made for zip ties. And it took no time to find that Rod Metzer had purchased those zip ties on December 30th, only 36 hours before the attack. It was extremely easy to identify that it was him, one, because he paid with his debit card, and two, investigators got the security video from Lowe's, and despite it being the dead of COVID when everyone was wearing masks, Rod was the only person in the store not wearing a mask. So, clear as day, they were able to see Rodney Metzer walk into Lowe's, pick out the zip ties, and purchase them with his debit card, once again displaying doofus behavior. And then came the video from his apartment building. There was a camera in the breezeway leading inside Rodney's apartment. Liver said there was no video of Rod leaving after he said someone knocked on his window. What they did see after the time of the incident that Morgan was attacked was Rodney come in, disheveled, in a hurry. Just 4 minutes later, Rod was caught on the camera again, leaving the building, wearing completely different clothes and sneakers, carrying a plastic bag, and the timestamp was 1:24 a.m. They never found that plastic bag in his car when they did the search, so they're unsure what was in it, but they assume that it was evidence that Rod discarded on his drive back to Morgan's house. On the security footage from Morgan's house, they saw Rod arriving back at her house after the attack. He rang the front doorbell, and then when there was no response, he headed around to her backyard. And as Rod was walking around the house, they caught him on camera calling out Morgan's name, as if he knew that she was waiting for him in the backyard, even though it was the middle of the night. They had an overwhelming amount of evidence. This case was a prosecutor's dream, but court cases are often very long and traumatic for survivors of an attack. So Deputy Chief Assistant District Attorney Rachel Ash wanted to offer Morgan an opportunity for quicker closure by giving Rod a plea deal. So they went through the pros and cons of letting Rod plead guilty, and ultimately they agreed that they should try. And they didn't have to try very hard because Rod took the plea they gave him very quickly. On August 4th, 2021, Rod pled guilty to a total of 14 counts related to Morgan's attack, including kidnapping, sexual battery, family violence battery, aggravated battery, and more. He agreed to serve 25 years on a 70-year sentence. So when he gets out in 25 years, he'll serve another 45 years of probation. District Attorney Shannon Wallace said in a statement at the time, quote, "This defendant planned an attack on his ex-wife that included breaking into her home, disguising himself, and pistol-whipping her. He left her outside on a cold winter night, face down, tied up, with a pillowcase over her head. I cannot imagine how terrifying this must have been for her." This is a classic example of how the most dangerous time for a domestic violence victim is when she decides to leave an abusive relationship. Rod is currently serving his sentence at Baldwin State Prison in Hardwick, Georgia. His possible release date is listed as December 31st, 2045. At Rod's sentencing, Morgan delivered a victim impact statement, several pages long, and she said, "Once I got started, it just started pouring out of me." Rod, not only will this statement be to my attacker, but it'll also be my last words to whom I thought was the love of my life. "The last 4 years being married to you was like living with a monster that constantly tried to break me down and fence me in. It was a blessing in disguise. I can now walk with confidence knowing the pain you have given me is turned into power." And that's just a snippet. And Morgan said she walked off that stand with 1,000 pounds off of her shoulders. It felt so good and empowering, and she said she felt like she got the last word. Morgan's best friend Nicole said it was awesome because Morgan didn't cry. Her voice didn't shake, and she said everything she needed to say. And when she was done, she was done. Morgan said this has been like a death. She lost her husband, and he's dead to her. Since this whole ordeal is behind her, Morgan has taken steps to recover, seeking therapy to help her cope. She's also focused on raising her children and also spreading awareness for the stories and rights of victims of physical and mental abuse and domestic violence. She said, quote, "I'm trying to raise awareness for narcissism and gaslighting, and I want to help women realize they're in a situation before it gets too bad." Nicole said, "I'm just excited to see who she continues to grow to become. She's beautiful and strong and resilient, so this is just a stepping stone in her journey." Lifetime made a movie about Morgan's story, titled Gaslit by My Husband, The Morgan Metzer Story, and it was made in 2024 and was recently released on Netflix. Morgan said watching her story play out on screen was really surreal. She said, quote, "I watched it and it felt like it was somebody else's story. And then every once in a while it would hit me like, oh, this is about you. Certain parts would make me a little sad, and then some parts I'd be like, I can't believe I actually went through this. How did I make it? And it just made me think women's strength is beyond powerful." Morgan says it was particularly powerful to watch the scene when Rodney sexually assaults her character in the movie because it made her understand that incident from her own life in a different way. She said, quote, "I didn't realize your husband could rape you, but he can. And watching this video, a no is a no, whether it's your husband or it's not. My husband said, you're supposed to serve me. And I didn't realize how much he actually raped me until I saw that scene. How much I was just, I guess, taken advantage of." Jana Kramer, who played Morgan in the movie, has also been very candid about her own experiences with domestic violence and also opened up about what it was like filming the attack scene, saying it was by far the most difficult. Jana was also in an abusive marriage to her first husband, Michael Gambino. Michael choked Jana into unconsciousness and left her bleeding outside of their home in 2005, after which he was convicted of attempted murder. He was sentenced to 6 years in prison and was released in 2010 and took his own life in 2012. Jana's story sounds very similar to Morgan's, and she said that this was a role that she really connected with. And Lee Gabbiana, who directed Gaslit by My Husband, was also reportedly a victim of physical and mental abuse as a child. She said directing the movie felt like telling her own story, saying, quote, "There have been many times where I thought I was going to lose my life, and the fact that Morgan and Jana were able to take these situations and live on and tell their stories and become the best versions of what they dreamt to be, that was my story too." While watching her own story on screen was challenging at times, Morgan says it ultimately feels empowering to use her experiences to help others. And it's very clear to me that that's exactly what she's doing. I mean, even just in the two people that she made the movie with. So I'm positive that there will be many, many people who watch the film who are able to connect with it and hopefully take something from it in a positive way. Morgan also said, "If I don't take the bad that came of this that I feel that God wants me to do, it's like, why did it happen? It would happen for no reason. I've got to take the pain and turn that into something that's powerful to help women." So Morgan is doing awesome work. She's taking this highly traumatic experience and using her story to help other women and other people who have been in situations similar to hers. And I think that's awesome and very brave, because this is a very vulnerable topic. Rodney Metzer's sentence prevents him from contacting Morgan and their children in any way, so she won't be hearing from him anytime soon, and really, hopefully, ever. But that is Morgan Metzer's story. It is extremely terrifying and heartbreaking, the amount of trauma and abuse that she had to endure for so long on top of this horrific attack and attempt on her life. But she is so smart and extremely strong and saved her own life. I hope that she and her family are doing well and get that much needed, much deserved peace and are just very happy because they deserve it. And also shout out Nicole because she seems like a great best friend and female friendships rock. So that's awesome too. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, you can visit thehotline.org or call 1-800-799-7233. Or text START to 88788. But I think that's all I really have to say about that for now. So why don't we have a bit of a palate cleanser and I can tell you my good thing so we can go on with our days as normal. My good thing is that the weather is getting nicer and I've been able to go out on walks more. Getting out and touching grass has been pretty essential recently. And yeah, I'm very much looking forward to the warm time, and seeing blue in the sky has been really amazing. So I'm enjoying just walking around my neighborhood and breathing in fresh air. And over the past couple weeks, I've also been making a pretty mean matcha latte, and sometimes it's just as simple as that. I hope all you lovely people out there are also getting outside and touching some grass for your sanity, because that's important. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. If you would like to get access to all of our bonus episodes, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. The link to my very first YouTube video will be in the episode's description, or you can check out Steph Today on YouTube. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you and you would like to send it to us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listener's episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. We have merch at nottodaypodcast.dashery.com and a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the T in the podcast is a 3 because that makes sense, and just keep breathing. Yeah.